This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
As some of you may have seen, in the back here you have an ongoing project by John Cage that consists in a work that will literally never be finished because one can always add to it. And I think for the foundation of this place, we were also looking very much at Duchamp as inspiration. And Duchamp is also somebody who makes, as an artist, works that make you think rather than just see. And in that sense, we can say that the works you have here are not usual works. They can be architectural works. What we like in the amazing production of Lebrus Woods is that his drawings can be seen as architectural, but also as art. Dennis Oppenheim also has worked at the cusp between many, many media. And so we just begin asking each of our friends to say maybe few remarks, 5 minutes, beginning with Alexandra, and then Annette will say a few words, and then Amy, and then we'll open to the public.
Good evening. Thank you for invitation. I would just like to use a few words exchanged with a friend sitting in the audience who was looking at the installation in the first room of Tectonic Forest, and she said, this is my first time at Slot, but I would know how to take this walk. It is uncanny to read these lines, given that they present part of my experience. My position is very different. I wouldn't know how to take the walk, but I have been at Slot more than once. I was thinking what to say here, within very particular relationship that I have with the work, let's say as an executor, not a role I'm particularly used to, even though my husband died in 2012. But usually when people approach the state and ask for something, they ask for something that is, quote-unquote, ready to go. Or they ask to see something that may not have been seen, but again, mostly to make it something that will be hung, that will be exhibited, that will be incorporated in something that is more or less, let us call it stable and static, even though those are very wrong words for exhibits. However, this was an example of a question that is an interesting question. May we deal, may we have a permission, in fact, to ask questions about this work and to offer some answers that certainly the creator could not have known, and where actually executor can be in a strange position of what might have been his thoughts, or even though these are friends, and what are your thoughts? What in particular are you trying to convey? So I would like to read few things that Lebrus wrote about this project for an audience not unlike this one, but on his blog. The blog has since appeared in its second life as a book, but the story of Tectonic Forest is not in it. So I went to the blog that was written, the note that was written in April of 2011 or so. So, here is the abstract of a proposal for the American Pavilion Venice Architecture Biennale 2012. In contemporary world culture, the United States of America is often looked to for the most advanced thinking in many fields, including architecture. This proposal addresses this condition in several ways. First, it exhibits the practices of emerging architects and firms from diverse regions of the United States. The overall aim is to show how these selected architects are transforming both architectural practice and the built environment by offering a rich variety of innovative approaches and works. Second, It employs an innovative exhibition strategy involving all electronic displays of work. Visitors to the exhibition will use multiple tablet-type computers embedded in some of the tectonic trees in the pavilion, as well as several with larger screens, to access files containing the work of the selected architects. They will be able to enter into the computer's keywords from a prepared menu that will bring up works from any of the selected architects related to the keyword. Visitors will be able to interact with each other and will be linked to a website, Tectonic Trees, allowing visitors to participate more fully in the exhibition. The unnamed organization will program a series of discussions and exchanges with the selected architects during the Vernissage Week. The result will be a lively atmosphere of exchange and exploration. Then follows a series of images, some of which are projected in the first room on the blog, and comes the text, this time in italics. But then an unexpected thing happened. At 11 o'clock in the evening, before the deadline for submission next day, when the submission package containing many forms, detailed budgets, production schedule, as well as installation design drawings was being assembled, the chairman of the board of the sponsoring nonprofit institute called and said the board had changed its mind and would not support this proposal after all. This act of betrayal effectively killed the submission. You won't see the tectonic forest in Venice next year. And the text closes with a sentence, but the idea lives on. So it's a very nice closing sentence of the blog and probably the opening sentence some years later. I cannot claim expertise on Bachtin, but there was there are several moments in all texts that accompany exhibit and even in those that are extracted from positions of individual authors that seem to question or open to question what do we mean by anything that might be called finalized and or finished. Are there other words with which one can operate that open more space for conversations and also for action? And so that would be maybe one theme that I would like to know more about in conversation. And another one is the invocation of responsibility that I am not sure whether the meaning of it being invoked has to do with almost something like intergenerational responsibility, assuming that here are works of, if I'm not mistaken, 1970, 1987, 2011. There is even a pacing between them that is quite interesting, and where all three seem to be proposing or inherently have a possibility for conversation to continue. Do all works have that in them? Would be one question that may take us outside of these three. How is responsibility for that conversation to be articulated? So just as Antonio Santelia said, each generation should build its own city. Yeah. I suppose the rest of the question is, but on what grounds? With what dialogical method? Because something of the past possibly will be there. And so in this sense, I wonder whether these three works are past, or whether they are something that could not be digested or went through the process in its own time, but remains open for interpretation. So that would be my comment, and I thank you for engaging.
I have a certain relationship to each of the pieces here, and I'm not in literature and I'm not in art criticism, but I am an architect, and it's interesting to engage with each one of these projects, not only as an architect but also as a pedagogue, because I not only think about building, I write about building, and I teach building. And so primarily the latter, I teach architecture. And for the questions at hand, that brings up a very particular demand, because the work that we do is usually very intensive and it's highly charged and it's highly analytical, but it stays within the boundaries of academia. And so given the recent political events, that question is on all of our minds, I think. You know, how to take the explorations and the theses that we instigate in academy and how to make it provocative enough or actional enough to have now the key word, which is impact. And you'll see that, you know, there are many awards given for impact, there's recognition given for impact, and that's become a code word, I think, for getting out of the studio and having something that is realized in some dimension. So I think it's, first of all, it's very interesting to see this come up in this work that in many ways I'm already familiar with. Libius Woods, I've never seen this particular project. I was very interested to hear your text because I didn't realize it was participatory. And that's another dimension which reads from work to work to work, a very specific dimension of participatory interaction between viewers, people coming to the exhibit, that was always a part of the narrative of each piece. So I think that's one thing that we could really talk about, the kind of dimension of participatory action, performance, in understanding the component of threshold, as you put it forward, that is engaged in very different ways by each piece. In the Libius Woods piece, I was really interested, I write a great deal about visionary work in the 1960s, and that work, it's very interesting to think about that piece because it is neither visionary nor utopic nor dystopic in familiar descriptions. It is certainly rhetorical in terms of breaking the institution, and so it opens up a funny question on what is the next step for it. If you follow perhaps Jameson on utopias, just the notion of utopia is often instrumentalized to various audiences to propel thinking about projects forward. But this is clearly not that. I mean, this asks you to think about the institution itself and then go on to answer that question about the rupture with the institutional boundary. So too with the Oppenheim piece, which is very familiar in terms of the same kind of challenge to the institution, but through methods of spatial practice, which are very familiar to urban studies students. If we've read Disserteaux, we know that the kind of claiming of public space, the writing of public space through the walk is part of this. And so it becomes very interesting that it's tied into now a political dimension in a challenged neighborhood where that is put into play. And finally, the Wojcicko piece, you know, I wasn't aware of this particular piece either, and it was interesting that the symbol of the City Hall is taken up so overtly. I don't know if I'm totally swayed by that, but what I was really swayed by is by the presence of the clock. And so I became a sort of a Wikipedia geek this afternoon and looked up the history of the clock. And so again, we have this notion of engaging. His proposal was to have the audience beep in with different kinds of codes if they'd gotten a job, or if they'd lost their job, or if they'd gone back to school. And it was so tied to the question of the timing of Philadelphia, because it used to be the largest clock in the world, the tallest building in the world. It still is, apparently. This I had no idea. It's the tallest masonry structure still in the world. And this clock was a technological marvel, not simply for how it functioned, but it stood as the pacing and the rhythm of all of Philadelphia. Right? People didn't have any way of syncing their timepieces, and so it controlled the start and stop of work, the rhythm of labor, the way the shopkeepers knew to open or close their shops. And so it worked as much more of a symbol. It was an instrument that engaged literally the participation of the entire workday. And so I thought this was an incredibly interesting way to intervene in that. So it's not so much the symbol of City Hall, it's the notion that that stands for a different kind of time. So that was my thinking. And of course, you know, you made me go out and read Dialogical Imagination. Thank you for that. Which was a wonderful kind of entry into all of the work as well.
Thanks for coming. I was reading in the Times yesterday about the fact that the Metropolitan Museum of Art gave their entire digital slide collection to Materials for the Arts in Long Island City, which is a kind of a warehouse where art materials can be deposited for other artists to come in and utilize. And the article described different ways that the artists used the slides. They took them apart, they made mobiles. So, and the title of the article was included the word Second Life. So there are all kinds of ways that one can think about Second Life. I mean, especially when we're all considering a kind of repurposing of things in our world. The planet's getting smaller, we need to utilize. So that's not what I ever discussed with Aaron, which was more theoretical in terms of what is the source? Is it a script? Is it a choreography? Are we doing a restaging? In other words, how do we approach this, which is kind of important theoretical, and just trying to say that there's a kind of a spectrum, a kind of continuum along which one can understand the ways that an idea or a physical material can be reutilized or repurposed. And the Guarded Land piece was done three times. Dennis's original version, and then we went to New Orleans and then in Philadelphia. So I'm learning a little bit more about certain conditions of what might be best called a choreography in terms of control, parameters, and participants. But when we came to do the installation, I, of course, was nervous about it because Dennis made works of art in which he documented his performances, and I didn't want to go against that in a way. So I thought, in very simple terms, what's important about the three ways that we enacted this work? Well, it was that they're all in the eyes of the people coming, spectators coming here, that they're, the impression is that they should be equalized to some extent. So the pictures were all made the same size, they had the same format, and they're all equally important to us today. And what was very important to me and to Aaron, as Dennis's work was a radical gesture that he considered when he was kind of getting in a taxi on the way to the airport, something that was very spontaneous. How do we keep the spontaneity, which was difficult in the institution in New Orleans, how do we keep the spontaneity but also make it a gesture relevant to the site, as he did consider place and site and the functionality, and he understood about urbanization and utilization of space and developers and all that. So I think when we came here, it worked well, as you mentioned, with the combination of the development of the areas around the university and the idea of guarding and controlling and security. So I think it was fairly successful. And I think he would have liked the way it was reenacted. And we had a great deal of enthusiasm from the students here. And I participated in some of the lectures, which made it I think, fun for all of us and active in terms of the school.
Thank you very much, Amy. I mean, thank you, all of you. I just would like to perhaps ask a few more questions before we open to the Q&A moment, because I see perhaps three different meanings of the unfinished idea. One, and maybe it was more present in Alexandra's terms, can send us back to a philosopher like Habermas, who famously declared that the Enlightenment was an unfinished project and that we needed to rethink democracy with more participation. And I think that in a very obscure way resurfaced in Nicolas Bourriaud's Aesthetics 15 years ago, when he was talking about participation, the aesthetics of participation, and so on, which I think is a certain key to some of these works. But there is also perhaps the other paradox, since we talk about architecture and buildings that by definition have to stand, at least not collapse right away. How do you mark the unfinished nature of some of the elements? And I'm these days working on people who work with perishable material, like things that are going to be destroyed, like rust and so on, and that will have to be replaced quickly because obsolescence will mark. And that's another approach. And then there is perhaps a more radical unfinished idea, and I think we see this in Lewis Wood's project, is something that cannot even be made, that has to remain open, and that as time perhaps more subversive, like an idea. And here I'm thinking of this interaction between, say, Bakhtin and a writer who developed his ideas in the 30s, Hermann Broch, was always talking about ethics and aesthetics. And for him, aesthetics meant that we were talking about an object. And the ethical moment was the moment when the object could be negated by a question. And so for him, the danger of aesthetics, as he famously said, is that it could create kitsch, like bad art. And in order to undo kitsch, only an ethical position that would be very, very visible would somehow prevent that kind of constitution of a monument, let's say. And this is why I like this paradoxical monument that Lewis would have in mind, which is more an explosion than a monument, or a monumental explosion. Does that help in your terms, these three questions? Or?
When we had the first exchange on email in preparation for meeting or meeting for the first time, there was this moment of finalizing the question of finalization. And I was thinking for a moment what relationship Lebius, as much as I know, had about finished, unfinished, finalized, and so on. And also what he might have thought about an object or an idea having so-called second life, if it is ever a second life, if there is stepping into the same water twice. I recall very, very clearly that as a teacher of architecture, he felt that it is ethical obligation of a teacher to assign project that can be finished, that can be finished, that all the people involved in the semester have to arrive to a result, or possibly to a frustration, but that, you know, that the aim of seeing something in front of you has to be established. Now, did he think that way about his own work? I would say that for him, being able to mark the full stop, the period, was a commitment one had to make, not a commitment, I'll pencil you in, period, or full stop, I'll mark you by ink. Now, that, and he did not return to projects years later in terms of let us see what can be added and what else can be done. I mean, it would, there would be something meta that would come out of that visitation. But I also know that there was never a belief that things end with him. Well, first of all, it is in practice of architecture that architect is not a sole maker of anything. His full stop really only opens the space for builders, for practicalities, for institutions, for ideologies, for negotiations, for dialogues, for betrayals, and so on and so on. So to locate anything in individuals' sense of finality or finalization, of course, would be almost absurd. His work on models and on projects, including this one, often included other people and was always predicated on some form of exchange or interpretation through a dialogue. So I think that he would be more than happy to see that that actually this happened. But I think that, you know, for me, not using his words or guessing what he might have thought, the main question really remains, what is for the generation who comes next that is appealing and that is read as generative? Because not all is. And even though there is always a curatorial team, there is even an individual who picks something, there are reasons why an idea is taken, can be taken, and can be developed. There is a promise of that idea. So I cannot answer that in relation to this text. I would say, for example, the one that comes closest to me as a viewer and as somebody who thinks and experiences certain things, it maybe would be the project by Dennis Oppenheim. The property, then also, I must say, the only clearly gendered presence walks through Philadelphia. I like that. Also asks certain questions about other two projects and where gender might be in them, and is it silent or is it active or is it yet to be read and introduced? But as for Lebius's, certainly with all these technological moments that that were included, the primary idea was, what are the limits? Are there limits? Is there even a space called National Pavilion? And that is truly the question behind it. So that obviously is not a question that has any finality. I think we are still rethinking it and will be.
Oh, Dennis died in 2011 in January. I think it was that summer that I came down to Philadelphia and built a small version of his upside down church with Aaron and his...
The Village of Arts and
Humanities. Where is it?
The Village of Arts and Humanities in North Philadelphia.
Yeah. Now, of course, one aspect of the whole thing is that at that particular time, I was feeling kind of isolated. And so his bringing me down brought me out and brought me with people and engaged. It was similar in the sense that we rebuilt a project that he actually had built three versions of. He liked to do different versions in different locations, using different materials, different colors, different ways of permanence. But now, that piece always had an aspect to it, which sort of for him, brought to the surface, or in its form, the idea of the unfinalizable, because the siding was not completely across the side. You could see part of the structure of the building. In other words, it was an incomplete structure that was this steeple, upside-down church, cantilevered on its steeple. So he tried to kind of work this idea into his into the physical form that he ended up with in the end of a thought stream. And he often tried to also bring in the process into the work. He'd leave tools in the sculpture, you know, indications of how he came to, how the idea came to his mind and how he generated it. So that was kind of a something that he tried to do in his physical form as a final statement, to let it show the process, and also to have, and a way of doing that for him was to leave it in a state that it was partially unfinished.
I just wanted to ask, maybe, oh, sorry, you want to say something?
You know, I was just going to offer that because we are talking about architecture so much that, you know, there's been a questioning in the last 30 years, but goes back even further, I think, to work that's defined as finalized, as classically disposed even. Some of that came with the questioning about the nature of the work always is unfinished by material phenomenal grounds, because of architecture weathers. It has to stand up to dynamic forces. Excuse me. But there's another thinking that was opened and radicalized, I think, by people like Chumi in the 90s, where architecture was about event, right? And over and above the object, it was how the event was embodied by the theatricality of its engagement, or by the simple presence of people in it doing things, and so led him to diagram architecture as choreographical elements, and focused on the kind of contingency to the human participation that that had also been taken out by all kinds of different people. Even Renzo Piano's Centre Pompidou, Piano and Rogers, was always conceived of as an unfinished building, where 40% of it was unprogrammed for spontaneous activity, and even the elevation of the building was thought not to be complete until people were in it acting upon the building. What I think is interesting in the kind of latest iteration of this, and I speak to Aravena's Venice Biennale of last summer, is that that notion of contingency to human interaction opened itself up in to become porous to different kinds of agencies, to different kinds of infrastructural conditions, to different kinds of affiliations with different political entities, that then tried to destabilize the architectural object and landscape in favor of its constituents in order to answer the needs of architecture outside of typical capital, especially. Because by making it porous, it also activated different kinds of financing, different kinds of construction. And so all of this, the destabilization became complete. Outside of any kind of aesthetic category, that kind of suspicion that to open it up to all of these different agencies would also make it available to a much larger participation by a number of different kinds of cultures, demographics, and economies. And so I think it's a really interesting trajectory to position that in certain work of the 60s to where we seem to be now, in understanding that these are all seeds of thinking, of rethinking these kinds of projects.
I just wanted to ask one more question before we open it up. Jean-Michel, in invoking Habermas, was kind of maybe mapping out what we might call a civic aesthetic that you see in these works, where the civic is being interrogated. But I also wanted to call attention to the the institutional aesthetic that's at play in each of these works. If we take Lebius's work, for instance, as Alexandra was mentioning, the kind of hegemonic identity of the U.S. pavilion is being questioned. The pavilion's being cloaked and concealed, you could say hidden, or perhaps even exposed in a new way. With regard to Dennis's work, the institution which is the New Orleans Museum of Art, for instance, in the 70s, is being interrogated. Right? Their tenants in the work, the guards are being asked to guard land that isn't that of the museums. Right? And so there's a critique of institutional power. In Krzysztof Wodyszko's work, again, the institution that is City Hall is being re-symbolized and re-synchronized so that the public, in a way, determines its social life more than, let's say, governmental figures. So I guess I'm interested in this kind of critical relationship to institutions that each of these artists developed and developed in the work, and where the institution is both subject and object. And I guess my question is, do you guys share this, I mean, it's a simple question, I suppose, but do you share this relationship to institutionality or this understanding of institutionality, which these artists seem to share, which is that institutions in a way need to be the focus of our critical faculties, and that in some sense maybe they are on some level pliable, that they can change over time, or that they need to change over time, which is, I think, today something that we're grappling with in society, where there's been a breakdown in trust facing institutions and a lack of social cohesion, maybe stemming on some level from a fundamental distrust of institutionality itself. And so I guess my broad and open question is, do you share this institutional aesthetic as I'm articulating it? Or as I think these artists and architects and designers are articulating it?
I would just have a little question. Is Slot an institution?
Well, of course, but it's also an institution that has made institutionality its project, right? And that has performatively navigated institutionality as such, right? Like playfully evading it at times, actively espousing it, at times kind of, performatively using the term foundation, at other times renouncing it. I think the history of Slot is to experiment with institutionality itself, and thus that explains, at least in my case, the fascination with these works and these practitioners, these artists who themselves had very critical relationships to field, to discipline, to field, to institution. Dennis would be, as we've long articulated at Slot, like he resisted signature style. He constantly moved into different methodologies, from ecological or land art to performance to installation art to public art, and Lebius had incredibly, as much as he was embedded and deeply respected within architecture, he also was very critical of the way that architecture was educating a new generation and architecture's political kind of complicities. And likewise, Krzysztof has done the same, often taking monuments and various institutional landscapes, sites, facades, and repurposing them in critical ways to acknowledge those that are otherwise unacknowledged in society. So I guess, I see these projects as, in a way, sister projects, as kind of having a fundamental kinship with what we're trying to do here. So that's a long-winded answer.
Well, I could say maybe one thing that is related to views of Lebius Foods, and then maybe answer the question more precisely, at least how I see it at this moment. In 1995, early in 1995, Lebius Foods was invited with a group of architects by an Austrian institution, major museum, to take a trip, no less, but to Cuba. And so there were 7 incredible days in Havana and around, for which he suffered for several years by being inspected every time leaving this country and coming back since he was on the list, until the case was taken by the Center for Constitutional Rights and the veil was, taken over, off. But the project of going there was to see Havana, to see the modernism of Cuba, not well known by all people, and to think about the condition of Havana and what could be the relation of architects, not Cuban, to that to that landscape. So he too did several projects, and one of them was called Meta Institute. In fact, that was the first one that he came up to, up with, and the reasoning behind doing that project was what seems to be necessary, and not only in Havana, and it is also paradoxical, not only in Havana, is actually to have an institution where the role of institution would be questioned. That would be its meta element. And that was absolutely his belief. And I believe that you are also meta institute in that sense. My position is, since institutions are not about to disappear tomorrow, it is possibly best practice if they themselves are brought into position or invited or forced to question, you know, the very resonator of their existence, even though existence is a very difficult thing to let go. And I think it would be a serious struggle if it were proposed. But it is beautiful, or only logical, or appropriate, or very fine, that something that was questioning institution was rejected by institution, could not go forth because of certain institutional practices, is then taken in by institution that has the questioning tone.
So maybe in to answer to your question, is slot an institution? I would say almost. Not exactly. But it might be time to have, yes.
The word unfinalized has been used for all of this. It's not a word that I've ever, that's come trippingly off my tongue before. But the word unrealized is something, and I have not heard that word mentioned, and so I assume it's purposeful. Unfinished has been mentioned. So could you talk about the difference between unfinalized and unrealized?
It originally, in Bakhtin's idea, it was a philosophy of the act, but very soon, as some of you will remember, he took a literary example, and I think that will be easier to identify imaginatively. It was Dostoevsky. So if you have read some novels by Dostoevsky, basically Bakhtin imagined that if you read any passage in a novel, you don't know what is going to happen, and everything that happens can be negated by the next page, and so on. So this is a little bit the model that he had. And so, of course, when you finish a novel, it cannot change. But it's more a certain experience of progressing through a text, a work of art, and so on, with this impression that ethically it's open, aesthetically it's not closed, and what he sees in this is a contestation of what he calls the discourse of orthodoxy. By its very nature, the fact that it is unfinalized is a contestation of anything that would be like a truth, handed down forcibly, and so on.
To just speak again to this distinction between the unfinalizable and the unrealized, let's say, in working on this project for many years, we were impacted and kind of referenced this extraordinary collection of eulogies that Jacques Derrida delivered that posthumously were published as under the title The Work of Mourning. And one of the things that he articulates in a number of these eulogies is the infidelity inherent in thinking that one could realize somebody else's work or somehow know it. And so in this project, we were very reluctant to pose these configurations, these installations, as realizations. Rather, we thought of them as conversations that clearly have a physical component, clearly have an installation aesthetic, but and enact that. But on some level, we wanted to think of them as just kind of one possible, let's say, approach that could be undertaken or espoused. Not again, realizations in the sense of the way that today in performance we often hear the term reenactment, but rather, again, just as engagements, as conversations that may lead somewhere else, that could be structured differently, that could take as many forms or directions as there are people in this room or visitors to the project. So that was another way that we're trying to build upon, again, this idea of the unfinalizable and not fix it. Right? And then with regard to the dialogic, right, this other extraordinary concept that Bakhtin gives us that Annette, I think, was going to speak more to, or at least has maybe could speak the most to, having just reread some of his key work on this topic. Again, we were interested in the possibility of an encounter as individuals, but also from an institutional or almost institutional level, that might imagine a scenario where the public is transformed by that conversation, the institution as well. And so we're also interested in that fluid understanding, both of legacy, but also of our own relationships to the work. So.
According to Bakhtin, any kind of finalization would be a destruction of any kind of growth of dialogue. I think what I brought forward from Bakhtin mostly was his ideas of chronotopes of time-space, which I thought was fascinating. In his terminologies, there were cycles of time that were addressed by certain texts that were ordinary time, cyclical time, daily time. And then there were other definitions which evolved that discussion. And he was talking mostly about time as novelists use time. But his idea of threshold here was crisis. And that destabilization of time that allowed a kind of marginality to take hold. And I thought that, if anything, that points to what you're asking, because you're asking, at what point in a kind of crisis are we that we come to a different kind of realization? And I certainly think in modalities of feminism, there are many crises all over culture and all over history. But are we finished? My God, no. No. The evolution is loaded, and it's multiplied by different cultures, but it's certainly not finished. Let's hope it's not. Let's hope it continues to grow.